This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/Keith Burgun. Hello and welcome to episode 23 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. My name is Keith Burgun and I am your host. In this episode, we'll be talking to Frank Lance, who is the director at the NYU Game Center. He's also a pretty prolific writer on game design, and I'd recommend looking up his videos and his talks and stuff like that if you don't know who he is. Probably a lot of you listening to this podcast are likely to already know who he is. He also designed the game Drop 7, which many people probably have played. But here's the conversation that we had. Enjoy.
Let me start by saying that I appreciate getting a chance to be on the podcast, and I like the podcast a lot. I like your writing a lot, and it's funny because there are not that many people that are out there that are kind of thinking about the topics that you think about, and there are also a lot of them the topics that I think about a lot. And I also want to say that there's a lot of stuff that we disagree about, which, mm-hmm. I think is useful. It's actually I think we disagree in a kind of useful way about a lot of stuff, which is, a good place to be, right? It's most people who are out there, writing or talking about similar issues. It's not like I have a useful disagreement with them. It's just that they're sort of we're on sort of
different
going
plans.
In two different directions. Yeah. It's just kind of orthogonal.
Sure.
And, where I think a lot of your project, right, your method and your approach is actually really interesting and really useful. I have found it personally, it has sort of changed my thinking in subtle ways on certain questions. I do find it popping up in my head when I'm looking at games, playing games, thinking about games. So it's because it's a testament to kind of the seriousness with which you've approached these questions and how you've been really diligent about kind of articulating them, that a lot of these a lot of your points of view, even when I disagree with them, I do find them kind of useful and interesting, and it actually has kind of changed my thinking on the margins.
That's the best thing that anyone could say. That's
good.
More important to me than you agreeing,
Good, good.
That you agree that I've said something and that there's this flag somewhere standing and you can refer to that flag in conversations.
Yeah. Now, having said that, I do think it's kind of funny that the degree to which we disagree on so many of these issues. It's funny because I find myself – because I think this conversation started with me joking. I don't think I never actually tweeted this, but I almost composed a tweet after your most recent thing, which was about – what was it about? Reading. It was about reading people.
Mm, yeah.
The topic of reading. After that, I almost sort of half seriously posted a tweet along the lines of that I was going to start my own podcast, my own weekly podcast, in which I just – explain everything that's wrong about Keith Burgun's podcast every week.
Nice. Okay. Yeah.
This is a point counterpoint.
Sure.
So it's funny that I find myself, in some ways very much aligned with your project and with your thinking, but often, on any given point, I find myself really strongly disagreeing. So
sure. I feel the same way for what.
Yeah. So I thought, so this is, I guess, an opportunity to kind of maybe dig in and explore some of those differences of opinions and see if we can kind of come up with a constructive path forward, Sam Harris style, the way he's always grinding his teeth and trying to find some common ground and with someone who strongly disagrees with him and inch forward along some problem.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of respect for that approach. So, so I thought, I listed a bunch of topics, that we could talk about. I think it was, randomness.
It's randomness, yeah. Execution, improvisation, and reading were the four ones that you wrote down. Yeah.
Right. And probably in that order.
Okay.
Is the right way to do
sure,
it?
Sure, yeah. I actually, just to sort of frame things, there's really only one thing that comes to mind for me, and it's almost like a meta thing that I would push back, that I disagree with you on, which is kind of interesting, which is just that I feel like and this might just be because of my perspective, but I always feel like you are embracing like not having theory. Like you're always like that. That's my only problem with you, anything I ever hear you say is when you know, it sounds a lot of the time like you romanticize the lack of understanding. And that's my only gripe with anything I've ever heard you say. But it's something that I consistently, that's the one thing I'm like, that makes me, you know, like, no. And want to do like a podcast, you know, responding to your stuff. Like your Against right. Design article is the one that always comes to mind for me.
I love that article. I often think, Keith, that most mistakes are mistakes of overcorrection. Like most human mistakes, like if you could put all the mistakes, if you had one, you know, theory about, you know, where the majority of mistakes come from in thinking, it's through overcorrection, and it kind of makes sense.
Well, could you be overcorrecting on this?
And yeah, I think we're just seeing that in both cases,
right,
there's
sure.
overcorrection, right? Yeah. So you look at a world in which you see no theory and there's no theoretical framework. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to impose, you know, this like rigorous and global totalizing theoretical framework. I see a world in which everyone overestimates their ability to predict and explain. Everyone is too in love with their models. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to like get people to kind of question their models and be less confident.
Right.
And so the truth is, you know, somewhere in the middle. I think randomness is a good example. I think you miss some of the value of randomness, or you overestimate the badness of randomness.
Okay.
And as a result, I might be like searching for ways to defend it. And vice versa. Like you think people overestimate the value of randomness. You see all these people like overrating it. And so you're like, okay, well, its value is zero, right? We could need to basically eliminate randomness.
Well, let me.
And I know you're not saying that, trying to get as close to that as possible. Let's get rid of as much randomness as we can.
Well, sort of, actually. Let me just state my position on randomness,
sure.
And then, so that we can, you know, work from there.
Okay.
So my position is that actually all games need to have some randomness. You remember I wrote that thing about how I think that games like chess and go are problematic because of their lack of randomness, that they have.
I never quite understood that either.
Okay. Well,
understood that.
So I think all games need some randomness, but it needs to be what I call input randomness, you know? So it needs to be, there needs to be an information horizon. So like,
why do you think all games need some randomness?
Because if they're perfect information, then it sort of becomes like, just a calculation contest.
And why is that bad?
What's that?
Why is that bad?
Well, why is that bad?
Yeah.
Because what you have with games like those are like very simple math problems. And it's like, how many of these very, very simple math problems can you do in whatever the time limit is? They become more contest-like. They become less about the heuristic kind of loose decisions, things that we really consider decisions without that randomness. And I think that the people who like really random games understand that. It's just that they go way too far with it. My complaint about randomness is actually not. It's all I would say is that the harsh output randomness of like you make a decision, then like something is decided. You know, like a combat to a two hit roll. Those are so right up front that they're like the information horizon is just right around the player, to the point where there's no like the structure of the game is being turned into like chaos and noise, and you're not embracing, you know, the structure. Everything is just sort of what do I do this turn, and there's no line going through some like a causal right. line going through the whole match.
And Keith, I think we should probably just pause for 1 minute and make the caveat that we are just going to be discussing a kind of small slice of games,
oh, yeah.
which are strategy games, basically.
Yeah. Which I think
guess
my
ortho games, as Richard Garfield calls them.
Which yeah. I think probably people who listen to my podcast will probably know by now that that's mostly what I'm concerned with.
But a lot of people might get confused when you're talking about, oh, games need this or that, and games should have. It's really confusing if you don't understand. Oh, we're really just talking about basically sort of two-player strategy games.
Sure.
So games that emphasize kind of the cognitive skills, decision making, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So just to finish up my thing, when you're able to calculate everything, the objective is to you just have to calculate as much as you can. And I know that in practice that doesn't entirely come down to that. I know that, people still do use those like loose sort of from the hip, like you talk about blitz chess and stuff like that, which where players are forced, they can only calculate so much. But the problem is that horizon of calculation, that shouldn't be decided by the player. That shouldn't be determined by the player, because then it's like this linear, it makes the skill of the game too much of a linear contest kind of thing, where you have 10 seconds. How far ahead can you look in the decision tree, and how many pieces can you compare and look at the board? How much of the board state can you analyze and calculate in those 10 seconds? And it becomes
versus what? So that's an example of a failure state of a game. If there's not enough randomness in it, becomes that what you just described.
Right.
Now, what's it like when a game is working well?
When it's working well, you have an information horizon that's selected by the designer. So no one can look outside of this little circle. The classic example is Fog of War, and so the designer selects, like, imagine chess with Fog of War. And the designer chooses, this is how much out I want players to be able to calculate. And within that calculation, I want players to make decisions. And so that does make the game more random. So I'm not against randomness.
Describe to me in one case I'm like, okay, I'm trying to, I can see these pieces. I can arrange them in my head. I can see the solution to this little math problem, and I can do it faster or better than you. That's the bad game. What's the good game?
The good game.
Describe it from the point of view of the player. Like, oh, I can see these pieces, and I'm trying to solve this problem, and I can do it faster than you. But then what's the extra thing that's missing from the game with no randomness?
From the game with no randomness, well, it's not as much that something is missing. It's more that you have the way that players don't really decide something with chess, or less so they do. More they calculate. Whereas if the information that's given to players is like, you get 100 points of information, he gets 100 points of information.
Right.
You make a decision. Both of you make a decision. Whereas they may be getting, in chess, they may be getting 150 points of information because they just looked ahead a little bit faster in chess. And that's, to me, the problem with one of the problems with, perfect information games.
So the difference is, okay, I think I'm understanding this. This is actually very useful. So the difference in your view is that what you really want to know is how good is my algorithm for crunching the observations I make, the data, and turning it into an answer. And if I'm just like getting more information because my look ahead is faster than yours, then you're not really judging my algorithm. You're not just judging my decision-making process. I've seen more data, so
yes, you're putting it better than I put it. Yes,
okay, interesting.
And I think that though is one of the. I think that a lot of players, modern people who play games, find perfect information games to be a little bit oppressive, and like to play. They're very stressful.
Yeah, but it's hard to appeal to popularity or what players like, because neither one of us is going to win that argument, right?
Yeah.
Nobody likes any of the kinds of games that we're proposing.
Right. No, that's true. But I think that I think that chess and games like those, like compared to something like Hearthstone, I think that, that really random games are not very stressful compared to chess.
Right. Right.
I think that's something that's, I think that that's because of this, I'm not feeling like, oh, I have to be like scraping to get all the information I can when I'm playing Hearthstone.
Yeah.
I can more just look at a very tiny circle and make a choice within that circle,
Yes. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And Hearthstone is really can be really fun in that respect. Like I remember when I was playing Hearthstone, I was trying to learn how to pilot the patron warrior. And I spent a lot of time just watching life coach videos and like watching how he analyzed situations. Like in a game of Hearthstone, there would be sort of a lot of these like smaller decisions. And then there would be one or two turns where there was this immense kind of calculation to make. Mm-hmm. Very complex and multi-layered and involving all kinds of hypotheses and about what the player, other player might have. And it was just like such a rich, interesting problem space. Mm-hmm. And I remember really getting into that, and then they nerfed it and I stopped playing Hearthstone. Right. 'Cause that's what I wanted from a game. Like I wanted the beauty of that was I wanted like a game that was both super hardcore and super casual.
Right.
Like I wanted a game that I could play at, you know, in a kind of a casual way and not like a super serious game, but then that had like a very hard, you know, interesting, difficult kind of problem solving aspect to it. And I'm sure that's still there in Hearthstone.
That's a good transition into the other end of it, which for me is that Hearthstone is too random and there's just too much content and stuff.
Yeah. I think we can both agree on that. So that's a place where we can find some common agreement where, In the grand scheme of like things that we agree on or disagree on, I think both of us feel like, okay, Hearthstone is a good game and a fun game. And I think there's a lot to praise about it, but I think we both sort of look at it and think, okay, this game is just too far on the end of random to be worth kind of like devoting a huge amount of time and energy to studying and learning.
Right. There's this very specific, like people talk about, oh, this is more random than that and stuff. But I have a very specific way of quantifying what I mean by more random. And it's specifically with regards to how far out is that horizon? You know, how far out, like how much information, reliable deterministic interactions are there that are sort of becoming like the scaffolding of, you know, that are building out the causal chain that makes this match. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
And so that's the problem with really random games. Like every beat of a really random game is just like its own game. It's like it's not building so much on the structure of a game. Whereas chess, you know, to its credit, every single turn is building on, and Go is even better in this. I've always loved that, you know, with Go, your first stone you place down still could have huge ramifications on the last turn. And I guess in a way that's true, but I think it's less true of these really, really random games where everything can just flip on its head.
Yeah.
And you can just lose because of something that you drew a bad card or something.
So far you've explained why games need randomness and you've explained why Go is a great game. Wait a minute. What am I supposed to do? What am I here for?
I thought
these were my points of view.
Well, but I'm just saying that I have a nuanced position on randomness.
I agree.
Yeah, it's
I do think maybe we should come back and revisit this algorithm versus data question because I think there's more to dig into there. But let's take a step back and keep going about because you also have I want to hear you kind of articulate your point of view about game outcomes and how randomness introduces noise that distorts the signal.
Right.
That the outcome of the game is given to the player and how important that is in your model of how it's judging.
Right. So I think from what I can tell, something unique about my work is that I look at a game match as a structure, like one thing. Whereas I think it seems to me that most designers, you know, it's sort of arbitrary, like when a game ends and, you know, how long a game will be. I mean, they might feel it out kind of, but there's no like structural need for a game to be certain length or certain, you know, have a certain like structure to it. Like so many games that I play are just do this thing. Now do it again a billion times.
Yeah.
And it could be a billion times or it could be 100 times or it could be 10,000 times. Like they're all very scalable. And because of that, they don't embrace the structure. And when they don't embrace the structure, it's like they're adding. It's like every little bit of structure gets added to the previous one. But when you do embrace structure, you're like multiplying. You're every extra bit of information, every new turn or every new phase is multiplying by the previous phase in terms of the value that it's sort of delivering and the depth of the game. So like a big thing, games tend to like reset themselves. Game states in most video games, they kind of just like you're playing and everything's reset. You're playing everything's reset throughout a match. In certain ways. Yeah, and I just think that embracing structure is a way to just make more elegant, better games, and one way to, and the ultimate structure is the final goal. Like, so I think that there is a fundamental thing about winning and losing, like a lot of people think of it as like some competitive like thing about trying to sort people and, you know, am I better than you or not? I think it's more you have a goal and did you achieve the goal or not? Like that's a binary thing. I think that inherent in goals is a binary yes, no answer to the goal. And so I just like if you have a goal and it's like got, you have some like continuous fluid answer, like maybe as the answer, which I think is what we do for the most part, like high score systems. That's why I really oppose those. So I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but my point is I think that the way to really embrace structure is to have a distinct goal, to build the entire match around that goal. And by doing that, we can have every moment of the system be supporting that goal and supporting that structure and building on itself. And I know that I think I'm being kind of like vague, maybe that gives you enough to.
Okay. And in your view, the one of the problems with randomness is that it introduces these disjuncts.
It severs the
structure. Yeah. It severs the causal connection between the decision I'm making. Hey, the whole point is to see how good I am at making these decisions.
Right.
And the whole point of the goal is to create a structure in which the outcome is related in some way to how well I made these decisions.
Yeah, the goal.
And if I can make a decision and then lose because a coin got flipped or a rare event, you know, occurred, yeah. And then what's the point of that? Like it's just going to confuse me. And I think you also emphasize the learning process, right? That a good game will, through the outcome, be teaching the players the quality of their decision making.
Yeah, you're learning about the system and the goal, the final goal outcome. I think of it as like a positively or negatively charged, you know, state that informs everything else going back through it, like ideally, you know. So if it was a win, well, then I can like follow the course of the causal course of, you know, how things went and led up to that win. And I'm getting sort of like rich feedback from that. Whereas if there's like some random weird fluke and I lose because of that or win because of that, it's actually sending me like a false signal. And so what that does is, and I think a lot of games operate off this like placebo fake depth. So players will start being like, oh, but you know, that one time I did this thing and it totally worked. And it's the only reason it worked is because there was some random fluke. So they're imagining all this extra depth that's not actually there, which is, you know, really great for game designers because it means that our games can be pretty shallow and players will just kind of like imagine like they're, you know, they'll create a story for what happened that makes the game sound way more interesting than it actually is. So I think it's, you know, it's, you know, in that way, it's a very useful tool, but I think that ultimately we can make better systems that, that don't rely on that.
Okay. All right. So let me see if I can muster a defense, for randomness. And I'll start by talking about what I think of as being sort of its pragmatic values. These are, kind of well covered in the Richard Garfield and Scaff Elias book Characteristics of Games in their chapter on uncertainty, and that's the things like the sort of psychological effects that allow for players to feel a little bit better about their losses, and it sort of softens the harshness of the of this what would otherwise be this very kind of acerbic experience, right, of like having my decision making tested and coming up, you know, and failing over and over again.
Sure.
Now it's like, oh, now this learning process that I think we both see the value in strategy games as providing for this long term process of learning and exploration, and games that sort of encourage and reward a deep understanding of the underlying systems. I think we're both kind of aligned in terms of seeing that as a fundamental value of these games. Mm-hmm. And so one of the pragmatic values of randomness is that kind of is that it actually encourages people to keep on that path. I think another kind of psychological kind of pragmatic effect is simply that it's pleasurable, right? There is just a primal pleasure in the suspense and resolution of uncertain events. You can think of randomness as a kind of a spice, as an ingredient that adds just a certain kind of primal pleasure into the mix.
Right.
Even if it's working at an angle to this logic of teaching, you know, in the most efficient way, mm-hmm. It can be seen as having this important function of just making the game more pleasant and more interesting.
So yeah, let me, those two examples, I think maybe you have more, but let me just respond to both of those. So the first one, I agree that it does work as, it makes it easier when you lose. And when you can tell yourself a story when you lose or win a lot more easily. And that makes it more pleasurable for you and easier, I guess, to dive into. And I agree that that's true. I think, though, that it does come at a cost, and that cost is like that efficiency. Mm-hmm. That's really my big thing about random games, is that basically whatever depth is there, you just have to play 10 times, 100 times more games to access that depth with random games, because you have to discount. You have to figure out, you have to play enough games where you can seeing who's the better player at a very random game. You can't just do a one match. You have to do like 10 matches, 15 mm-hmm. matches. And then you start seeing, okay, I see it. Now you're starting to weed out the noise. So that's my point, is that just, you're right, it does have that effect, but it also comes at a cost. And so I think, I personally think it's not worth that cost, but I think that designers should be aware of that cost.
Yep.
And then what was the second one again?
Just raw primal pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so my answer to that is, I think, yeah, you're right. Like, when something unexpected happens in a random game, it's, like, exciting. You know, the classic example is getting a natural 20 in Dungeons & Dragons or whatever. Or critically failing or whatever. Anything crazy happens.
I have never heard that expression before.
Natty Twen?
A natty Twen. I love it.
Yeah. I don't even play much D&D. I have a friend who does. But anyway, those things are exciting. But the thing is that... unexpected things can happen in unsolved systems. They don't have to just come from randomness. Like there can be, we could develop, like the, I think the problem is that we assume that we're going to need random events in order to surprise the player, because we're not building systems that are very deep by the merits of their actual interactions and their actual deterministic interactions. But I think that if it's possible for us to make deeper systems that do surprise the player for entirely deterministic reasons that are not random. And so that would be my answer to that, is like, yes, you're right, that is very exciting, but we can achieve that in a better way that doesn't have the costs of harsh randomness.
Okay. There's a sort of a third element in this category of the sort of pragmatic values, which is the way it provides a built-in handicap. So it sort of opens up the range of Garfield describes the effect of randomness as lowering returns to skill. I am going to win, the better player will win less often. So this is what you, when you're talking about that I now need to play 10 games to see the amount of information that about my skill level that I would see after a single game if there were less randomness.
Right.
He calls this a lowering the returns to skill.
Okay.
But what that does as a benefit is open up the range of player skill players against whom I can have a game whose outcome is uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that's a pretty profound benefit. Right. Now, all of a sudden, there is not just like a very, very, very narrow band of other players that I can have a good game against. There's a much broader range of players against whom I need to bring to bear the full, all of my skill, all of my thinking. I need to be playing at my best. I need to be thinking as deeply as possible because, I may have to overcome a handicap that gets introduced by a random event.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, a player I can play against a player who's better than me, and I need to be bringing to bear all of my thinking and thinking as deeply as I can, and trying to solve the game as efficiently as I can in order to take advantage of a positive handicap that might get randomly introduced. And so that works with the kind of uncertainty that we already have about our relative skill levels to really open up the community of play. Now all of a sudden we have a much more robust community. I can find games, I can play games, I can have dramatic games against more of my games are satisfying and interesting. The important thing about that is that without that kind of community, no game can truly be deep. Right. In order for a game to become truly deep, it's not enough that it have some set of formal intrinsic properties.
Peer review, right?
It needs to be played.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're going to compete with chess and Go and poker and these other games, you better have a game that gets played for at least decades,
mm-hmm.
If not hundreds of years. And if you want to get there, you better have a robust community of players who can find games and satisfying games against a wide range of players.
Yeah, I think that is a very solid, pragmatic reason for including randomness. And I should note also that that scales. You can scale that all the way to the game has no skill. It's an entirely like social game, like a party mm-hmm. game or something. The more you scale towards skill, mattering less, the wider the band gets of who can play against who.
Right.
I think there's a couple things in there. One, the same answer as the other thing. Yes, that's fine. It's just that there's a cost.
Yeah.
Also, in baked in here is an assumption that games are two player or multiplayer rather than just one player. And I think we had a little conversation at one point about how I actually think that maybe the natural state for strategy games might even just be one player.
We can't even though. There's no way we're gonna. We can't get into that here. The middle of this randomness discussion, that's just too bonkers.
Yeah.
I agree that that's an interesting topic, I think we can just put that one aside, right? Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Or maybe later on in this one.
Yeah, either way, I'm just saying that would be part of my answer for that.
Okay, I hear you. All right, so that's just a sampling of some of the pragmatic values. I think there are others that we didn't touch on, but I think we have a good understanding of, and we sort of, I think where we might disagree is in the cost. I think at the end of the day, you see the value of efficiency, of the clarity of the signal, of the outcome as being worth more than the benefit that you get from these other, that the trade-off you have to make to get these other benefits. And so I think we could have we could argue about that, but I think we kind of agree on the what we're talking about there, the terms of the deal,
One thing.
There's a second.
Go ahead. Go on.
Well, I was going to say there's a second category, which I think is probably more substantial, which is the intrinsic value, right? There's an intrinsic strategic value of games with randomness, strategy games with randomness in it, because they test our capacity for probabilistic reasoning.
All right, hold on. Before you get into that, though, there's one more pragmatic value that I would actually add to the randomness thing. And okay. it is a value, but it also is, I think, an interesting point, which is that randomness makes games way easier to design. I don't know if that's been your experience.
Okay.
But that's definitely been my experience. Like, designing a deterministic game that still works and isn't like just, you know, 100 by 100 like calculation horrible.
Right.
You know, a game that someone would actually want to play, but that's deterministic, that is extremely hard. And once you add in a few, like, you know, dice rolls, random things, it's like, oh wow, all of a sudden it's like so much easier.
You can almost think of it like procedural content generation, right? By introducing randomness, you're now making a little system that sort of generates puzzles for the player, and there's a wide variety of them, and every time you open the box, you're getting a different set, so there's novelty,
right?
And some of them are going to be easy, and some of them are going to be hard, and so you're exploring this world of possible little that's a good example.
But I would say to designers that they should definitely consider, like, to me, when it's easy to design a game, that seems problematic. Like, that seems like maybe that's a problem. Like, maybe games shouldn't be easy to design because we're creating this system that human minds are not going to be quickly solving. And so maybe they're easy to design because there's actually not that much there, and mostly it's just going to be going off exploiting human tendencies to find patterns where there are none.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. I see your point. Sometimes I think that there is an aspect of game design which is more like discovery, where you search around the sort of corners of different possibility spaces and kind of different rule sets, and then occasionally you stumble across one that is sort of just deeply interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And worthy of like a very long-term study, because it has all kinds of unexpected, like for example, Conway's Life, right? The mm-hmm. cellular automata, that particular rule set, people have now been extrapolating, exploring, and, you know, spending lifetimes trying to sort of understand and learn all the ramifications of. Mm-hmm. And just recently, just like a few weeks ago, they discovered a new spaceship. I don't know if you know this.
No, I didn't know.
They discovered it, like, it's got some – people were, like, flabbergasted because they thought, oh, we know basically everything there is to know now about the important structures in Conway's Life. Uh-huh. And just a couple months ago, some guy's like, hey, has anyone ever seen this? And you're like, holy cow, dude. It's like this, it's this vertically traveling spaceship. It has one of the lowest, if not the kind of lowest speeds of any structure that's been seen, or of any traveling structure. And people are like, whoa, this thing is amazing. And so people are still like, it didn't take Conway that long to find that particular rule set.
Right.
Right. He didn't spend a lifetime doing it. Conway doesn't even care that much. I met him once and was like, as a game designer, you're really inspirational to me. You're working games and stuff. And he's like, hey, I'm not that interested in that anymore. You know, he's just he's not that into games. But you know what I mean? Like, that's a sense in which, you know, Conway's Life is deeply beautiful. It's really that rule set is like profoundly interesting and deeply beautiful. And it's not the result of like effort, like effortful, you know, it's the result of like a clever person looking, you know, in a good direction and finding something and recognizing that, you know, having good criteria for recognizing when he had stumbled on something, you know, really deep.
Right. Sure. What was the second, you had a second category of like,
okay, the second category is the intrinsic strategic value of randomness, right? Which is the way it tests our capacity for probabilistic reasoning. This is a difficult, important, and interesting and challenging aspect of how we make decisions mm-hmm. under conditions of uncertainty. And it's not enough to say that it is its own separate thing. And if you want to make a game about that, then it has to be just about that, right? That it's, oh, this is just a game about odds, or just a game about, you know, it's a gambling game. It's just about how well you can.
Don't deterministic games also have this?
I think they do.
So I don't like what. So how is this a value of randomness?
Well, I mean, randomness. I mean, that's a separate point, right? I think that's one of my later points I was going to make, is that it's impossible to escape randomness anyway, right? So the prohibition against randomness it may be just something that is kind of a quixotic mission. But in this case, I think it's as a designer, you can introduce concretely introduce mechanics that are designed to inject noise into the system mm-hmm. at certain points. And you may do this not for any of these other pragmatic reasons that we talked about, but specifically to complicate the decision-making process in a particular way.
Okay. So an example would be, you know, I mean, a very, very simple example would be like you have a situation where you can, you know, I don't know, kill a monster or something. And now we're going to add like a D6. And so now there's like an odds thing on top of it that you have a 1 out of 6 chance of
right.
killing the monster. The funny thing is though, like most cases of randomness like that, I guess maybe you should give me an example of where you think that was done, maybe, or how that could be done in a way that would be interesting. Do you have any, like, does anything come to mind to you as like, oh, they added this in and now it did that? I guess maybe an example might be like something like Summoner Wars, which has those dice rolls for combat. I don't know if you played that.
I haven't.
Or I don't know. Yeah. Do you have something that comes to mind for you as like a game that's like,
well,
maybe.
I would say I would point to any game, right? Because most strategy games are using randomness, in some way, right? That in that probably using too much randomness. So, you know, pick a Euro game that you like, that you think has too much randomness in it. And I could say about that. So what's a game that you, what's a Euro style board game that you
like? That's too random. I mean, most Euros are pretty not random, that I know of anyway.
Okay. Well then maybe, you know, maybe we don't disagree that much, but I guess maybe we could look at poker, right?
Uh-huh.
So poker, like now poker wasn't designed in the ways that you're talking about,
sure.
Where someone introduced this. I mean, poker is built around, you know, poker emerged out of a pure gambling game, right? Mm-hmm. Let's just cut the deck for a dollar, and sort of became this strategic game, or sort of like evolved these strategic aspects.
Mm-hmm.
But the result, I think, is a case of a extremely interesting cognitive problem to solve. Right, I think it's in some ways more interesting as a decision-making problem space than a pure strategy game like chess. Right, in some ways it's more challenging to find the correct decision. You know, part of this algorithm that we are honing as we learn the game and understand its systems involves this ability to think about overlapping sets of probability, probabilistic outcomes.
Yeah. So with the case of poker,
which
I think
is not the case in chess, right? It's just like chess tends to foreground the calculation, and the probabilistic aspects are kind of percolating in the background. Like at a certain point, you got to like imagine a board state and say, well, this looks like a 70%, like white's ahead by right. this, you know, and so you're using some probabilistic thinking in the sense of like, well, I've traded away one of my major pieces, but I have much better, and you're using these heuristics that are kind of fuzzy. And so there's probability there, right? But in poker, you are starting with probabilistic reasoning and then calculating on top of that. You're saying, okay, these are the 20 universes I could be in, mm-hmm. right? In the first 10 of these universes, this would be the case. In the second 10 of these universes, this would be the case. I could take this action, which would, you know, collapse these universes because it would, you know, and it only makes sense when both of these conditions apply. And in these other universes, there's these separate, these other conditions, and this move wouldn't work. And so you're like starting like from a position of kind of radical uncertainty where you have to sort through these different possibilities that you're in and then think rationally on top of that, which is incredibly hard to do. And what we do, what actual smart, you know, thinking and decision making in the real world actually looks like, right? It looks a lot more like poker than it does like chess, which is one of the reasons that von Neumann, you know, looked at these two games, and you know, when he was developing game theory, he was looking at poker and trying to understand poker, and he looked at chess and he said, that's not a game, chess is just a math problem. Like he's like you in that sense, right? He was he's like, I'm interested in poker. Now that's a game.
Right.
Because in poker, you have to be like thinking about this range of possibilities of your own actions and the actions of your opponent and calculating on top of that. And is that even possible? So that's the sense in which randomness, I think, has some like deep intrinsic value as a kind of cerebral, cognitive, decision-making, beautiful and meaningful activity.
And is that because, are you, just to be clear, are you saying that it's like, oh, we have to make these kinds of probabilistic statistical analysis things in real life, therefore games should do it? Is that kind of?
No, I'm not saying therefore games should do it. I'm much less like you in the sense of having proscriptions and prohibitions about what, you know, what games should do and what games shouldn't do. And I'm more like, I think there's a wide variety of great games. Like there's really just one cure for cancer that's out there, and we should be seeking to find it. But there's not one great strategy game that's out there. That's the difference between medicine and art.
Well, this, you know, actually, what I mean? There's, yeah.
I'm like, oh no, these are all potentially profoundly deep and meaningful and beautiful games. And there's no reason that we should, you know, prohibit ourselves from exploring these in favor of just this other set.
But all right. So just because that sort of gets to my issue with my only issue that I have really with your when you're writing and you're speaking is that you often come off as saying that any proposed guideline for better design are of equal value. Like anything anyone says, it almost sounds like that's what you just said, like that almost everything is equal in talking.
No, that's definitely not what I said.
Okay.
That's definitely not what I mean. And no, that's a straw man that I can understand why you might think that, but that's not what I'm saying, right? I am saying that there are a huge variety of interesting directions to explore as a designer even within the narrow category of strategy games. Mm-hmm. You know, one direction is games that are deterministic and super efficient at coupling their outcome to the chain of decision making that led to the outcome, right? And that's just one mountain, you know, in a big chain of mountains that are many sizes and shapes and all worth climbing.
And are you saying you have no opinion about the relative value of those mountains?
No, I think some are better than others, but I do think I think poker as an example of a mountain that is a very different size and shape is not fundamentally of lower value.
My thing is that I think everybody has everyone has things that basically everyone has design criteria. They do have ideas about what they think is good design and bad design. Overall, I know that, yeah, there are many, many different angles to take, and everything is like a cost benefit analysis, and you know, everything, there's a wide variety of directions that anyone can go. But even with that said, I still think that everyone has some operating guidelines for like this. Generally speaking, this is like probably a bad idea. Generally speaking, this is probably a good idea. And
where do those criteria come from?
Reason, experience, you know, thought. I mean, what do you mean? Where do they come from?
Well, I mean, they don't spring fully formed, you know, from the vacuum.
Sure.
Right. They come from someplace. Right. They come from observation and reasoning.
Sure.
But my criteria for judging games goes a little bit more like this. Right. I look for games, for strategy games, in which very, very smart people are playing them for a long time in large communities and building a conversation around them that indicates that they are thinking and analyzing and developing concepts and sort of building a shared insight into the game.
Okay.
Right? So when I see that, I tend to think there's something there. Right? And if you, you know, and so, you know, that's less about looking at the game. I don't even need to look at the game to make that judgment.
Sure.
I need to look at the community of players and the literature around the game and the discussion that's happening.
I think that's
closer to my criteria than looking at the game and saying, oh, this game has a lot of randomness in it. Therefore, it's, you know, it can't meet my criteria.
Right.
I'm saying if there are people in it who are much, much smarter than me and have the same kind of values that I do, in that they want games that are meaningful and beautiful as decision making, you know, process of decision making, that test their ability to engage with like complex rule sets and extrapolate their deeper ramifications and learn over time and dedicate themselves to like serious study and discover new and surprising things about it. If they're super smart and that's their values and they've been playing this game, you know, for a long time with other smart people and pursuing that, then that's a good criteria.
Investigate. That is
there are not that many games out there that meet that criteria, right?
Uh-huh.
There are some. Poker is one of them. I think chess and Go are games like this. I think StarCraft is a game like this. I think League of Legends is like this. And there are a bunch of other games that I think are like this. Then there are other games that are out there that might have the capacity to support that type of play and that kind of community, but for whatever reason just haven't.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting to kind of look for games like that and to try to like discover like underappreciated gems.
Sure, sure.
And then as a designer, mm-hmm. looking for games that can produce that behavior, I think is my goal. Like when I design a game of this
type, how do you do that? Are you claiming that like how you would go about making a system like that is just a complete like blank slate? Like you have no.
Of course not.
Well, so
no, of course not. You go there. Well, there are a bunch of different methodologies for game design. You know, one of them is you're like, oh, well, I'm going to make a game like poker, but that has this like. That I'm going to flip some aspect of it, or I'm going to do something original. I'm going to remove something, or I'm going to invert some quality, or I'm going to do something surprising and interesting, or I'm going to introduce this other thing from this other game that I like and see what happens when those two things come together.
Right. And what's influencing those decisions is some kind of greater design philosophy that you have. Like you have some kind of design philosophy that says like, you know, maybe we should take poker in this direction because I think that generally this is something that it seems like it should work. Right.
Sure. I think I have, so this gets back to the fundamental question of like, how confident should we be in our models? And I think my big, the big thing I was trying to communicate with the Against Design article is that we are way overconfident in our models, right? What tends to happen is people, like there is a, we underestimate the amount of randomness, the amount of kind of contingency and arbitrary events that lead to the outcomes in the world. We underestimate them, and instead we tell these stories after the fact that fit our model, and then you know we take as evidence of our model that this outcome occurred. This happens in economics. It happens in science. It happens in our emotional lives and in our relationships. It happens in politics and it happens in game design. So here, let me explain to you how I made this big hit game. Well, we did this, and then we did this, and then we did this, and then we did this. I think the alternative that I'm suggesting is not to just throw your hands in the air and do nothing, or just throw the I Ching and do whatever it tells you. But it is to just have a lighter touch. Like, you still have to have models, right? You can't think without any kind of models, but you can have a more flexible approach to thinking about these problems. You can say, well, listen, this is my model and I'm using it right now, but I also understand that it's flawed and in ways that I can't even hope to understand. Yeah, it's incomplete. And so I'm going to have a light touch, and I'm going to, it may be wrong, and it may be wrong in small ways here, and it may be drastically wrong in other ways, and I never know. So I'm going to be aware and sensitive to the thing that I'm looking for beyond, does it match my criteria? Right. Beyond doesn't match my criteria, my objective criteria that of the intrinsic qualities of the game, and more sensitive to, does it match the criteria of the behavior that it produces? Right. The capacity of players to engage with it over a long time, to be fascinated by it, to learn it, to do a deep dive and continually discover new things about it.
So roughly, do people like it? Basically,
well, that's not what no, because people like a bunch of junk that doesn't encourage and reward like study and learning. Uh-huh. But we're talking about strategy games, so we're on par. I think we're aligned in our evaluation of what makes a good strategy game by and large. Right, this kind of lifetime learning that you're constantly discovering new things, that you're extrapolating the ramifications of this rule set, and it's constantly like giving you new things to like study and learn and get better at. Mm-hmm. Right, that. I feel like there's more trial and error. There's more tinkering. In some ways, I'm. This is like a Nassim Taleb position, right? Have you ever read Nassim Taleb?
Yeah, I have.
The Black Swan guy. Okay. So in some ways, this is Nassim Taleb's critique of like the story of science, right? The story of science is that we have this theory about what makes things fly, and therefore we build an airplane, and it uses our knowledge of how to make things fly. The reality is that the Wright brothers like tried a bunch of different stuff, and then one of their things worked. And they kept going in that direction.
Yeah,
and then
we added stuff. Even the one thing.
And our knowledge is always kind of ad hoc. And we still don't quite fully understand how wings work. But it doesn't matter, because he's celebrating tinkering and trial and error and the inventor mindset over the story of the genius scientist who starts with a full understanding of flight and then executes an airplane on top of that understanding. And that's the position that I want to suggest for strategy game design.
Okay. So, all I'm trying to say is that there's a sort of an undercurrent, and I guess you're saying you're responding to, you see most people as being like me, in that like most people have these very rigid, formal, criteria that they lay out, and they're like, here's what makes a good game.
No. I don't think that.
Okay.
That's not my position.
That's definitely not it seems to me like there's only a handful of people, or at least prominent people who really try to do that, that I know of
And how are their games?
It varies, I think.
It's been a mixed bag.
Yeah, sure. It's a mixed bag because like anything else. I mean, my point is that everybody does this. It's just about whether they do it out loud or not.
Yeah.
Everybody's doing the same thing. Everyone has a bunch of criteria and they have a model and they have, you know, a grand theory for what makes games great. It's just a matter of they say it out loud or not. That seems to me the difference between me and someone who, like, you know, basically pretends that they don't have criteria. And I think a lot of people do that. And that's the thing that bothers me.
I think most people who are making games don't really think about design all that much to begin with.
Yeah.
Then the ones who do think about design, many of them are not making strategy games, right? And then they're making other kinds of games and they have their own different processes. So that's kind of like...
This would apply to any kind of design at all, not even interactive, like just graphic design, any kind of design, any kind of creation.
Yeah. I don't know. But again... To me, I look around the world and I see something like Magic the Gathering and my radar goes off. It goes crazy, dude, because Magic the Gathering had its best year of all time last year, right?
Okay.
After what? Two decades? I don't even know how old that game is.
Something
right?
like that.
So, and it's also, if I tune into it, if I start like watching a couple of matches, I'm like, oh, wow, this game is still interesting. Like, this is not dumb. These are not a bunch of dumb people wading around in a shallow pond and fooling themselves into thinking they're doing something smart. These are a bunch of smart people, and the ideas that are going into the game, like, both from the point of view of the players and the designers, continue to be kind of interesting and different, right? So there's, to me, and then I was like, okay, well, where did that game come from, right? So then I look back and I look at the process of Richard Garfield coming up with Magic the Gathering, and I'm like, that's likely to be a good way to make games of the kind that like. Now, that doesn't mean that I think Magic is perfect or that Magic couldn't be improved on or that. But by God, it's a mountain, right? It is a mountain on the landscape of strategy games.
Sure.
And I think there are other people who look at Magic and they say, oh, well, look at this toxic, you know, money-making scheme that's attached to it. Well, that just disqualifies it from being a great game. Oh, look at the amount of randomness that can, you know, you can study really hard and then still lose against a worse player. That just disqualifies it. And it's like those people, I think, are not seeing the mountain. Mm-hmm. I think they're looking at a picture of a mountain in their guidebook, and then they're holding the guidebook up in front of their face, and they're not seeing, you know, the beauty and the kind of interest of this incredible thing on the landscape with all of its flaws. And all of its problems.
Right.
And so where did Magic come from? I mean, Richard Garfield just had this insight. He's like, oh, what if you had a game where everyone was a card game where everyone was playing with their own separate set of cards and there were like rules on the cards. And then over time, you're like exploring this big space of possible combinations of rules because every time you played against a different person, you were getting exposed to these different rules. And it's like, that's it. That sounds more like John Conway stumbling across the particular rule set of the cellular automata of life. Then it sounds like, oh, I'm going to like apply these like criteria, design criteria in this very logical and deterministic way and arrive at a game that is truly great. So I just want our design processes. I just want my design process. And different people have different processes and there's so many different ways that arriving at a great game. But for me personally, I just want to be open to both of those things.
Right.
Now, honestly, I think because I believe in self-improvement and self-overcoming, I think I probably need more of your approach because I already am naturally inclined towards this more intuitive or more organic process of discovery. And that's one of the reasons I think I'm drawn to your project and drawn to your thinking, mm-hmm. right? So I could use more of that as you know in my thinking. But honestly, I think you could use a little bit less. You know what I mean? I think you overestimate the accuracy of your model, as everyone does. And I think one of the great moves in becoming truly smart is this Copernicus move of recognizing, you know, this parochialism, right? The idea of parochialism, the idea that it's unlikely that we were born at just the right time and place that we would witness the pivot from bad games to good games, right? This idea that we're living on the threshold and we're going to be the ones that see this thing that up until now games have all been poor and not even, you know, worth really spending a lot of time with. But then like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're going to see this great confluence.
It weren't for the fact that computers came along in our time, yes, then I would agree with that.
I think you're right there. I think you're right. We do live in an unlikely period in the sense that we live in the early days of computers.
Yeah.
And I do think that that's an important thing. And so maybe part of what your project is about is kind of understanding the ramifications of what happens when we bring computers into the mix. And this kind of think that computers introduce about thinking, right? The way that computers have changed, not just the way we design games, but also the way we think about thinking. And so if we're making games that are about problem solving and decision making, these machines, which have transformed our ideas about problem solving and decision making, are also going to change our perspective. Yeah,
but I also think we also are, because of computers and the explosion of video games and stuff, we've just really started the project of trying to uncover truths about game design, about the discipline, and about, you know.
So- yeah, well, that's another thing where you and I think disagree, and I think David Deutsch is on your side, and this is where I think David Deutsch is at his weakest. So really smart guy. The Beginning of Infinity is this incredible book. You and I have both read it recently. He's a physicist with big kind of philosophical ideas about knowledge and reasoning and
constructor theory is his big thing.
Yeah, it's just like, it's a really profoundly, I think, important and moving book. When he talks about aesthetics, I think I'm a little bit more skeptical of his approach, and it's partly because in my model of aesthetics, and I may be overestimating the strength of my model as one does, but in my model of aesthetics, it is. Part of its purpose is to exist in a realm beyond deterministic reasoning, explanation, logic, and you know that there needs to be an outside of instrumental reason. That instrumental reason cannot bootstrap itself into existence, right? Hmm. That it needs, there needs to be
it's a independent context of physical reality.
I don't know about that, but I just think that part of the purpose of art is to, like, you have values which tell you what you should accomplish, and then you have instrumental reason, which is how you accomplish things. Mm-hmm. I think by and large, strategy games are the pursuit of instrumental reason. Like, how do we gonna, here's a goal, and how are we gonna accomplish that goal? That's a problem to solve. How good are you at, like, understanding the system and solving this problem?
Uh-huh.
But the ways that we go about that, within chess and Go and StarCraft and Street Fighter, there are things that are right and things that are wrong. Mm-hmm. That's the essence of them. Like, you can just be flat out wrong. And so as a player, you can, in fact, everything you do in chess is wrong, pretty much, right?
Right, sure. Some degree of wrong.
Because there is some, you know, solution to chess, and we don't know what it is. And so we're just wandering around, you know, the margins of this solution. Mm-hmm. But there is this one thing that you could do in chess that's right. And we're kind of like on this long journey to get closer and closer to it. But chess itself, like the invention of chess and things like it, is not also this same thing, right? Because that is where chess comes from, needs to be the land beyond chess, right? There needs to be an outside of instrumental reason where we bootstrap our way to shared values. And I know that this is all very fuzzy and philosophical, and I think but I do think that it's important, right? And I think it has to do with, I don't know if you know, I don't know if you've read Nick Bostrom's book about superintelligence.
Oh, no, I haven't read that one.
It's really worth reading, man. Mm-hmm. Really, really good. It's really interesting. It's enough to, like, take a singularity skeptic and dial them much closer to okay, this stuff is worth paying attention to and being interested in. I think Bostrom's, you know, argument is really, really well set forth and really well written and articulated, and it's a smart book and really funny and interesting. So, but one of the most interesting things in that book is this idea of coherent extrapolated volition. If we are going to have like super intelligent AIs that implement our values or that are constrained by our values, what are the values that we're going to build into those things?
Right.
Whose values? Like, is it the person who invents it? Is it the nation? Is it, do we vote on it? Mm-hmm. Do we just like inscribe the ones we currently have, knowing full well that they're flawed and problematic? Or is there some way we can get to some better version that is like the result of like what values we would have if we could spend thousands of years just thinking about our values and being our best selves in pursuit of the best version of ourselves, mm-hmm. you know? And so that to me is gets into this realm that is beyond kind of direct instrumental reason. And that's the realm from which we pluck things that are beautiful and we come up with these criteria for like, well, what is worth it? Like, is it worth studying Scrabble? Is it worth studying chess? Which one of those, you know, things is more beautiful? Like Scrabble has this weird memorization problem in it. And it seems like a ridiculous thing. Is it worth weightlifting? Like, is that a life wasted? Like if we just figure out how to turn our bodies into machines that lift, you know, that can lift weights, running, is that worth it? Or do we want these things that are more improvisational, or do we want these things that are more about stories? And, you know, those kinds of questions, mm-hmm. those are questions of values, right? Yeah. And I think that's where you need to a little bit step outside of applying your methods, because you're talking about where those methods come from. Like, you're talking about bootstrapping your methods. You can't already be inside of your framework in order to make judgments between different kinds of frameworks.
Yeah,
okay. That was my big sermon about it.
I mean, all I would want, granted, is that we can use reason to develop like better by some criteria, better values, better morality, better arts. And I think that we do all of those things. Like, we've been doing all of those things, and we will continue to do all of those things. What irritates me is just the sometimes there's a desire to deny that anything is better, that anything, any value is could possibly be better, or, you know, like that any criteria could be ever be better than any other criteria.
And I'm certainly not taking that position.
Right. Yeah, I think.
But I will say, I mean, Keith, don't you agree that there's in those three examples that art is somehow like fundamentally different from the other two? Or do you think that morality, politics, and art, don't you think art?
I think everything is
nature.
Everything like, is reason. Everything is like, you know, I don't think there's a hard line between art and science. I think art is just a very, very soft science. Probably like one of the softest sciences.
Right.
So I maybe that's a thing we disagree on, but I think it's probably like many of the things we disagree on. We don't disagree on them quite as much as, you know, maybe it sounds like when I'm writing independently and when you're writing independently, it sounds like we're on different planets. I think that's because we are both trying to pull the conversation in a direction. Does that sound sort of right?
Yes. And it may also be, you could think of it in terms of like who we're imagining that we're talking to. Like, you're saying, oh, I'm talking to this set of people, none of whom really are thinking logically about how they design games, and they're just kind of stumbling around widely. Where they need to hear that there is a rational process that will get them more of the results, whatever the results that they're looking for, right? Whereas I tend to be talking to like a much, much smaller set of people. I'm honestly talking to like this small handful of people that I think are already in this conversation, mm-hmm. and are paying attention to and already have their models and their methods.
Right.
And it's people like you and Dan Cook and Richard Terrell and Jonathan Blow and Soren Johnson and David Serlin. And you know what I mean? And these are the people. So it's maybe a smaller, tighter. And in that case, there's a different baseline, you know, that that. So that explains one of the reasons that our vectors are pointing.
Yeah. I think we could probably go on. We didn't get to any of the other bullet points.
Maybe we'll just do those. Maybe this will be a series if you want.
Sure. I'd love to do that. Yeah.
Cause I think execution, I think would be fun to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I have, at some point I would love to tell you, I have some prohibitions of my own. I don't want you to think that I don't have any, things that I'm against in design. Yeah, I have some that I'm like strongly against, and I think it'd be fun to.
That's what I kind of have been trying to needle at is, you know, I know you have those things and I guess I would like to hear you talk about those more. And I guess you would like to hear me, just kind of hedge a little more with when I sound not so certain.
No, I don't want you to just change your language. I don't want you to have exactly the same attitudes and opinions and then just like stick caveats on them.
I'm not that certain of anything. I don't know why you think I'm
You sound really certain. It's like you very rapidly listen. We shouldn't get back into it, but I think that's clear. But you also kind of like you very rapidly go from having an insight about randomness, like output randomness has this problematic aspect, mm-hmm. to being like, oh my God, we need to have a neighborhood watch for output randomness. We need to eliminate it from our games because it has this negative effect and has this big cost. Whereas I'm more like, well, I don't know. I mean, there's output randomness in all of these games that are truly great and deep and beautiful games.
Right.
Maybe it's not as bad as you think. Sure. And maybe there's a bunch of reasons where the cost that you see is not as bad as you think it is, and the benefits are greater than you expect. And so maybe there are other things to worry about. And it's a note, it's a useful note to make, but it's not worth getting quite as worked up about.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I hope, like we started off by saying, I hope that, you know, as a strong statement, it works as like that flag planted and there's that thing you can refer to. And, you know, that's kind of, I just want there to be like a point, you know, here's mm-hmm. a vector. And that's not to say that I don't believe these things. I do entirely, but I'm, you know, to clarify, I'm not totally certain about these things. And as you mentioned, they do come, like, I haven't thought these things for more than 5 years or 6 years or so. So, you know, I definitely know that I could be wrong, and I hope that they just function as good, at least as good conversation pieces, even if they're totally wrong.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I just want to also highlight this thing that we touched on but never came back to, which is the decision-making algorithm versus the kind of data observation function, right? The one that's collecting looking at all the positions and calculating, you know, the outcomes versus the algorithm for choosing between them. Mm-hmm. I think that's worth flagging and coming back to, because I think that's a really interesting insight into how you think about this whole thing.
Yeah, no, that's a really good way of thinking of it. I had never verbally or, you know, thought of it that way. That's a good way to verbalize it, I think.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot for being on. And
great. I really appreciate it, Keith. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon. So that concludes the conversation with Frank Lance. Thanks to everyone for listening, and thanks again to Frank for being on the show. And let me know what you think of this episode and how you think it went. I'm looking forward to your comments. And take care. I'll see you next time. This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.